community.
Vibrant people.
A representation of our expanded strength.
Identity crisis.
And inability to be exterminated.
Legacy.
Roots that are established way beyond geographical placement.
Recognizing our combined struggle.
Migrating community.
Bridging gaps.
History. And
I don't know.
Welcome, everyone. This is Diaspora Diaries, a podcast powered by Transmission Roundhouse. I'm your host, Awa, and today I'm here with Tariq. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Tariq. I am a poet, public speaker, and facilitator, but mainly my poetry focuses on people, power, and politics through poetry and spoken word. And yeah, delighted to be here, make my first feature on the Diaspora Diaries. It's been long awaited, but we're here now, so I'm happy.
Do you consider yourself as part of the diaspora?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Consider myself as part of the diaspora. I'm obviously raised in the UK, but my life, the culture that I come from, was shaped by Jamaican and overall Caribbean values. So I do see myself as British, but I also see myself as a descendant of the homeland, which is for me Jamaica, Grenada, and Trinidad. So yeah, I definitely feel rooted in that identity more than obviously what was said on my passport, which is a British passport.
In one of our earlier conversations, you mentioned being third generation. What does that mean to you?
Well, naturally, third generation would mean that obviously my grandparents, they came to this country in the 60s and then had my parents, and then they were second generation. So I'm the descendant of, obviously, my parents, so third generation. What it means to me depends on where you grew up. I find talking from a purely cultural perspective of my heritage, I feel like naturally the more generations that follow, the more diluted your culture gets. And we live in a globalized world anyway, so naturally you're going to pick up certain things of the culture that you live within. But it's been hard. I've had to be very intentional with connecting with my heritage because my parents didn't grow up in the Caribbean. They grew up here. So as much as I have Caribbean influences in the way that I was raised, I'm very much a London-born Jamaican, Grenadian, Trinidadian. So it's about me investing in that sort of learning. And I think I could speak that for a lot of third-generation young people who maybe their parents can talk the language and maybe they can understand it, but they can't speak it. And then, you know, then when they have their kids, it could be they understand parts of it. And then by a certain time, it's going to be, you know, people are just talking English. So I feel like it's a very conscious and intentional process as a third generation to pursue your heritage and roots. Yeah.
I can definitely relate to that. From my perspective, identities are anyways like fluid and they change, and we're not like rooted in one culture. Even when you live like in the same country your like past generations have lived in. But I definitely agree that especially when you're part of minoritized groups, it is so meaningful, at least it was to me, to really make sure you keep some kind of bond to like your parents or grandparents' culture and homeland, which is like to some extent a bit weird, like that we're so obsessed with like some countries and homes and territories and stuff. But I feel like it does help when you live in a society where like you're always kind of shown that you don't really belong.
When you say obsessed like with home, with like some countries, what do you mean by that?
I meant with the territory very specifically, because like cultures also move, you know. The example of London is perfect. Like the Jamaican culture, for example, here is like so strong, and there's like so many groups and people that have like recreated and rebuilt like different identities, different cultures, because they always move, you know. And I think when we look at very specific territories, like for example going back to Jamaica, even if your family is not there anymore, we still want to go back to something that's not really present anymore, in the sense that the culture has changed. What you know is your parents, which is already not what is in Jamaica anymore because they grew up in the UK. But still we build these links and bonds between like different territories, especially in cases where we're always discriminated against and oppressed, like systemically speaking, if that makes sense.
I think I agree. I feel cultures evolve naturally, and you can find home in the people that you associate with as well. So if your family's moving over to the UK, you can still be part of that Jamaican culture because it's the people around you that allow that to still live on. But I think there's value in being in an environment where everyone is kind of unified under like a collective identity. I feel here in the UK, we are connected, but I think there's a lot of conflicting opinions about being British. Like, you could call yourself British, someone else might not see you as British. Everyone has different perceptions on what it means to actually be British and how you can qualify. But when you go to somewhere like Jamaica, you obviously still have those sort of perceptions towards the diaspora about, are you really Jamaican? You was born in the UK and vice versa. But just being around people that look like you, speak like you, where your cultural values that you hold every day and might be looked down upon in the UK, but when you're at home, it's natural. It allows you to relax, to be comfortable. And I think that also is what home is about. It's where you can be your true self. And I think that's why people are maybe have an affinity to going back to the motherland. And I think there's something powerful in like the mother as well, not like obviously birth, but also how you are with your mother. Again, comfortable, relaxed, yourself, accepted. So I'd say that like that also adds to it for sure.
How would you describe your art? What drove you into poetry?
Okay, I'll go backwards. So I first started writing poetry in April 2023. That's when I started.
Quite recent.
So it started just, I was working abroad at the time. So I was working in Abu Dhabi. So I was seeing a lot, I was learning a lot, meeting different people, and also wanted to find a way that I could express myself. I can't always pick up the phone. So I wanted to write a little bit more. And I was reading a lot on like philosophy as well. So I think I was spending a lot more time with self and in silence, and wanted to articulate those thoughts. So I joined Poetic Unity's Instagram Live and like waited for a performance slot, performed my first poem. It wasn't that great, but it made me want to continue and come back the next time. When I came back to the UK in August 2023, Poetic Unity were looking for people to work for them. And I applied, managed to get the role. And within the role, it was about being comfortable on stage, and you have to perform. Sometimes you have to set the example for other people as well, make them feel comfortable in the space. So over the time that I was working at Poetic Unity, I was performing every week, which meant that I had to write quite often as well. I didn't like performing the same thing. So it was kind of like a victim or champion of circumstance. Let me say champion of circumstance. Shared experience is a great way to get people to open up and feel comfortable being themselves. So it was a necessary part for me. And my art, I think before even poetry, I started another account on Snapchat called Mr. POV, Mr. Point of View. So it was about breaking down the surface level and revealing the depth and the importance to things. I've always kind of wanted to help people and teach people, and I was reading a lot at the time. I started to write about politics because I felt like it was very exclusive with the way that they would frame things, the amount of jargon that one would use, and people would tap out of politics thinking that it doesn't affect them, it's not for them. But politics and power and people affect everybody, whether you're someone who works a retail job down to the aristocrat who lives in Austria. Politics is always shaping society, shaping how you exercise your freedoms as well. And I thought it was very fascinating. And I wanted to make a way that it's entertaining, but also my messages can get across because it's a lot to digest. So yeah, I focus on edutainment, education and entertainment, hence why there's so much punchlines and wordplay and all of that.
One of the main reasons why I wanted to talk to you and wanted to invite you on the podcast is because you have this thing where you blend things that I would typically associate to academia, like numbers and concepts in which we dissect how like the system works and how the system oppresses, especially. And so I was wondering if there's any specific books or any specific experiences. What inspired you?
Philosophy was like opened up my mind. I've always been someone that wanted to teach people things. I like explaining things to people, helping them, empowering them so that they can go on and use those tools for themselves. When I started to read philosophy, I started to ask more questions, and questions is the pathway to knowledge. That's the vessel that one must use. So I was asking myself a lot more questions, and that's what I wanted my art to do, is leave you with a question and let you think about it and come to your own conclusions. You come to your own point of view, because there's an element in truth in all perspective. So yeah, I'd say people that inspired me, 19 Keys, he's a thought leader in America, and he breaks down masculinity, the black experience, also like activism within America and how black people can create generational wealth. But he's specializes in like self-mastery, understanding self, but also the world around you and how you can leverage your identity to create certain things for yourself and manifest things. I just thought that was really interesting, but sometimes you can talk things away. Like me and you are having a good conversation, we're talking for half an hour. Someone might tap out after 5 minutes because maybe the concepts are unfamiliar or they're not really interested. So I was like, what's a way that I can get your attention for 3 to 4 minutes? Poetry is an amazing form of that, because people come to listen to you. Let's say your poem is 3 to 4 minutes. They listen to every word because it's a poem, right? So there is a space for putting those numbers and statistics and that jargon and breaking down concepts. There is a space for that because you're making people feel as well as educating them. So I'd say that's what inspires me. Long-winded answer, sorry.
Let's try and ground this in one of your poems. Let's listen to an extract of Continental Corruption.
For the mouths that are always asking, they trade it and market and trade our market, so it's corporate carnage that leaves corpses for caskets. Know if they want your bag, they'll come with more than a few baskets. They'll put a pound in and trolley out all the stock that you're parked with. These supermarkets aim at the working class. That's another definition of target. They're armed with disarming answers to wire straws that were grasping. I had to stop watching time when I clocked. It was alarming, but I had to wake up.
With me, I like to build relatable metaphors. So obviously I said trade it and market. They export and import and market as their own. Then they trademark it and put their own laws on it so that we can't touch the things that they've taken from us. And then the corporate carnage that leaves corpses for caskets. So it's just kind of alluding at the destructive nature of capitalism and how under the laws of capitalism, and obviously they created the laws as well, anyone who creates any rule for any game is going to have an advantage. It can leave destruction in its wake. And I used the concept of a supermarket and supermarkets as like two living and breathing metaphors pertaining to the fact that there are people that exist that are investing little and extracting a lot. It could be down to brain drain, or it could be down to even with like France and uranium. They take a lot of uranium from like Niger, and uranium is used to make electricity, and then they sell it. So France buy the uranium from Niger, have refineries, which a lot of countries in Africa don't have refineries. The refineries is what converts the natural materials into a product. And then they sell it back to Niger for like 10 times the price. That process of extortion and extraction is something that we live side by side. And it's hard to explain that to somebody, but using the concept of the supermarkets, I tried to kind of make it a little bit more relatable, a bit more understandable, so you can get your head around the concept.
What I found very interesting about this part and the one that follows just after is precisely that you situate yourself in all that. Mm-hmm. Because I think one thing that I find a bit intricate myself, even when writing poetry, is that we talk about a lot of things, but then obviously like awareness is important, but awareness is not action. Awareness is not the thing that is going to change things directly. And so I feel like we all have a part of responsibility in that, mm-hmm. and like bringing it further than just knowing about it. And obviously sharing is already doing a lot, because mm-hmm. the more people know, the more people will want to act upon it.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's also the thing of, what do you do with it? So how would you locate yourself and like situate yourself, place yourself in all the things that you talk about?
Mm. Even with what you were saying about action and awareness, I feel in the practical world, action is execution, and that's like maybe the most valuable part of one's process. But I think awareness is like the first action to get the final action. I think bringing people to awareness and having awareness of self and awareness of the things around you, and not only are we oppressed, but we're part of the oppression as well. I think becoming aware is, I would argue, one of the most important parts of that process. I think the change in something is like the key. That's when you know that you've basically completed that cycle. But to become aware of oneself, it allows you to ask yourself questions in things that you wasn't really questioning before, which will eventually change you. There's certain things that because you've become aware of it, you won't do anymore. And because you've become aware of it, you will do. You'll take an extra second to think about something. And that, a lot of people will silent quit. They'll be like, do you know what? I can't change the world. The government is doing X, Y, Z. I'm just me. What does it matter? But your awareness is what they're trying to prevent, because they know how powerful it is when you are aware. And this is with social media, it's a powerful tool because it puts pressure on a lot of the people who are making these decisions, because people are becoming more socially conscious and more aware of self, more aware of mental health. Young people are, for instance, willing to leave a job quicker than someone from the older generation if they're not happy, if it's affecting their well-being, because they see they're aware of the effects. Poets are not activists. And I had to like accept that with myself, because there was times where I would say something, get the clicks, get the claps. But at the end of the day, I haven't done anything. Yeah. And then, you know, you're also getting acclaim from telling someone else's story. I think there's a quote, but it just basically says that the role of the poet or of storytellers is to tell the story of the activists, the people who are making the changes, and then also bring people to awareness. So my position is make people more aware of the issues that are going on, and then, you know, hopefully they choose to try and make some changes or educate somebody else.
What I find super interesting is that you studied finance and business. Because you talk about capitalism so much and racial capitalism, it's like so central to everything you do in your poetry, I feel like. Initially, it felt a bit antithetical to me. How have your studies informed the topics you touch upon in your poetry and the angles you take? Have they?
Have they? That's the key, have they? I think what my studies gave me is like, it's changed my method of thinking. So I'm much more analytical now. I'm very focused on strategy. So it hasn't given me content to explore, but it's taught me about the way that I would approach a poem and what I want from it and what I want people to gain from listening to it. I ask myself a lot of questions, move things around. I see making a poem as a puzzle for me. I could write really good sections, but then has to be a certain level of synergy in between. Because if I'm just ranting for the whole time, then I could lose people. So I need to maybe move this around. I need to chop this down. I need to make this more clear. And that's what, when you go to university, it's about technical writing. You know, what perspectives can you bring in? Can you compare something? Can you evaluate it? Can you analyze it? I think it's helped me in my approach to my art, which has been positive, because I don't feel many people think like that in the creative realm. That's sometimes it's been difficult for me, because I'm always thinking one step ahead. You can sometimes take yourself out of the moment and take yourself away from the stream of consciousness that wants to say this, but you want to put it in a box and frame it and sculpt it and mold it so that it's ready for the stage and you can take them where you want to take them. So I believe in balance, but I also believe in imbalance as well, because sometimes there's going to be seasons where you're going to need to lean into framing things, whether you're submitting something or you're speaking to an individual who needs it in a certain way. I'm going to need to lean into this. But as long as you're aware of it, I think imbalance is okay and sometimes necessary for you to climb. I would also say, though, what my degree did teach me is the layers, the amount of depth and thinking that goes into the systems that they create. Like, for instance, tax and enterprise zone. So like an enterprise zone is like an area where the government won't tax you because there's an incentive for you to set up your business operations there so that they can generate some more revenue throughout that area. That's such like intricate thinking that goes into these things. And usually it's at the detriment of people. A lot of the time I sit in my lecture like, oh, damn. Like this is what's happening. NGOs as well, we studied a lot about NGOs, and basically a lot of like NGOs essentially is money laundering, really. You got like the peacekeepers in the UN, they're all in Africa really, like to count as like counter-terrorism. Like you learn about a lot of different things that are going on, and even the way that it's framed in education as well, you can see what perspective they're trying to push forward as well.
You also mentioned this in Continental Corruption when you talk about charities, right? Or were you trying to access something different here?
First of all, artistically, I love the scheme. The metaphor is literally the bread making process. So it starts from how much do you need? So you need the dough. So when you're making the bread, so how much do you need? I guess it's every day make dough. That's why they struggle to break bread. And then obviously breaking bread, Last Supper was the breaking of the bread. But they give out Last Suppers, like charity is free. So essentially, they mask themselves with good intentions and deceive people in believing that this is out of goodwill and this is out of charity. But really, it's like your Last Supper. So like anything that you're dependent on can be weaponized. And we see that with dollarized economies or economies who are dependent on the IMF for loans. Like what happens is, yeah, it's like a debt trap. You know that they're not going to be able to make their payments. Then you claim certain national assets that you take for yourselves. There always seems to be a benefactor to these charities, and just looking into those sort of systems, you kind of see how sinister they can be. So yeah, that was like what I was trying to definitely portray, illusions behind some charities.
That reminded me of something Mohamed El Kurt said. He spoke about how decolonization and human rights is a multi-billion industry and that it does benefit the ones that organize it a lot.
You know, even what's going on with the immigration at the moment and people's stance on that and being British and, you know, even like hearing some British people have their opinion on being proud to be British, but having such a limited understanding of what Britain is and was and what it represents. They wouldn't know that the Caribbeans and Africans fought with them in both of the world wars. They wouldn't understand that, you know, the amount of murder, rape that went on within the British Empire to obtain all the assets that they love. They don't know that Barclays and Lloyds were slave owners first, and that's how they built the banking system within Britain, is by how much money they were accumulating from slavery, and they didn't know how to put it in. The insurance industry was built from slavery. So it's like, what are you proud at? Like, what are you proud for? Because some people are proud to be British and say that they're kind of like the leaders in the moral sphere, but a lot of your founding values were built on murder, exploitation, genocide, oppression. And I think some people are picking and choosing what parts of history they want to be proud of. So yeah, that goes back to the migrant stuff, just because there's a lot of conflated opinions about it. But Britain are going into these countries, making them war-torn, and then when people are fleeing, have the nerve to say something about it. So
I think, to a certain extent, and we spoke about it in the previous episode on memory politics and collective identities, depending on how the nation state is framed and the national identity is framed and like the collective memory generally of a country, which is taught in schools, is framed, there's so many things that we might miss. And that's why it's so important to have access to alternative spaces, I feel like. And I think, to me, spaces like spoken word nights, open mic nights, all these things are so important to actually just talk about the things that are not taught in schools. And That's why your poetry, I think, is so important. At the same time, I feel like sometimes it's difficult to situate yourself and know how to not romanticize. I found your point earlier interesting about recognizing that you're a poet and not an activist, because I think it's easy to fall in the trap of thinking that that's it and that we've done the job and we've done the activism, when really we've expressed ideas and we've communicated very important ideas, but it's not necessarily the action that activism tries to push.
Yeah, I think we all have a role to play, and obviously you can play one role, but there are other roles that you can play. I'm proud of my role, but I find it easy to recognize someone who's doing a lot of the work on the ground. I'm sure me and that person would look at each other and be like, I can't do what you can do. But I think that's the beauty of coming together and working together, and maybe me working with an organization who is promoting those values and trying to capture their essence and what they want to achieve in a poem. Which is why, for me, I do a lot of passion projects. So, like, any organization that's doing something that I want to stand with, like, I won't charge them. I'll ask if they want me to create a poem to capture the essence of the event. Yeah, like, those sort of things, passion projects where you just get involved. I think that's a big space for these storytellers, these people that can make films, pictures, paintings, poems. You know, reach out to these activists because you can help in that way. Like I said, you're an important part of the initial action process, which is awareness and getting people to be like, you know what, I'm going to think a little bit more about how I live my life, or go further to donate, or go further and get involved. So yeah, we play a really, really important part, but it's important that we don't overstep our ego and say, yeah, I'm an activist and things like that. So I just say I'm on side and try to help where I can.
I love that. I think I want to emphasize again the idea of mixing different things, getting involved in different areas, putting your strength in the places where they can actually like help and develop. Balance different mediums. Go over to activist spaces or activists and contribute what you can contribute, but not just stay within your bubble. And I think it's very similar with academia. I think very often a lot of the research in academia and social sciences is confined to one very specific space, and it doesn't go out of this space. And especially when it comes to questions like race and post-colonialism and decolonialism, it's just the kind of thing, it should happen on the ground. And I do value the research that is being made, and I think it's very important to push certain ideas further.
Even just adding to that point, there's no reason why those sectors can't combine and create.
Exactly.
Yeah, so like 1 + 1 = 3. What I love about researchers is they'll grab a statistic and the story behind that statistic and why it's important. Like, no, it's not just 40% of XYZ happens to this people, but they're showing you that the impact of that and the larger societal consequences. So if they worked with a creative and said, look, if there's anything in this report, have this in here, this in there, this in there, and this in here, this means this. And then someone who could create could make a poem out of those things and explain, give a feeling behind the story. Humanity is hanging by a thread, false stitching, for they want us to believe our world is tight-knit, knowing we create victims and detain witness and witnessing destruction to preserve peace. Like, someone tell me how you spend more paper to preserve trees. See, society has normalized trauma and it's become our new default. So we no longer can identify those who never paid for their ways to destruct and destroy. The ones that fill our heads with enemy lines and that the remedy lies with seeing nuclear weapons deployed. It's the ones that keep clips on hips that hit legs like groins, then repurpose the replicas for gifts as toys. This concept is based on basically, you know, like how Darwinism describes human nature and characteristics. First of all, a lot of like human psychology and behavior has come from the study of Europeans, and we could see how they would view different races as more evolved and like also have that sort of bias towards what it means to be white. So we've got like very Eurocentric opinions on what it means to be human. And I find that power, they say that it's kind of within our genetic code to be power hungry. But I said, what if they want us to believe that that's the default, so they don't pay for the power that they hold? So yeah, again, I love metaphors, but it has to make sense. I never want to sacrifice the essence of the poem by putting in a wordplay there. So essentially, what they normalize, you charge it to life. Someone died, that's life. There's wars, that's life. And then we don't hold these people accountable because we believe that we're all capable of doing such things. That's the process of assimilation. That's the process of normalization as well. And that process is really critical for me, because it's not that you don't see the problem, but it's the lens that you're using to see it. So that layer beneath is where we should all be looking at. Not the problem itself, but the way we see the problem and the way that we see normalized behavior. So yeah, it's just an important point to contest, because there's so much of European psychology that us as black people, or just anyone who's from a underrepresented group or minority group, we've internalized these opinions and tried to understand our own characteristics. For instance, again, in the Caribbean culture, like talking to yourself, like, yeah, you got like a lot of grandparents, uncles, aunties who just like talk to themselves. They're communicating with themselves. But that would be listed in like the DSM-5 or psychology as like a symptom of schizophrenia. So there's like a lot of black people who have been misidentified as like having a mental illness. But again, it's just coming from that lack of cultural understanding. So yeah, I just think it's important when we need to recognize what we accept as the default, as normalized, the things that we don't ask questions about, because that's usually the things that are the most important, which they don't want us to question.
Thank you for joining me for this episode.
Pleasure.
If you have any comments, if you agree or disagree, we'd love to hear from you.
Absolutely.
This was Diaspora Diaries, a podcast powered by Transmission Roundhouse. Thank you so much for listening.